SBS Radio.
Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit is unumstossbar.
Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. He's fired!
Au nom du peuple français!
Wir schaffen das.
Make our planet great again.
Don't worry, be happy.
I will kill you if you destroy my country.
Better is always possible.
Let's do this!
I ain't spending any time on it.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason in the gallery for SBS World News. This week we'll have special live coverage from Singapore of the historic first meeting between the leaders of North Korea and the United States.
Based on the recent statement of North Korea, I've decided to terminate the planned summit in Singapore on June 12th.
Well, Kim Jong-un got back on his hands and knees and begged for it, which is exactly the position you want to put him in.
In a moment, we'll speak to Balbina Huang, who served as senior special advisor to US Ambassador Christopher Hill, who attempted to negotiate nuclear disarmament with Pyongyang 13 years ago.
For once, we have an almost evenly matched game. For once, we have two leaders who, it is not just one leader, meaning Kim Jong-un, who is the unpredictable one, the one that we're not so certain is crazy unpredictable. We also, for the first time, have a U.S. president who is also uncertain, seemingly crazy, seemingly unpredictable. We've never seen that in a U.S. president before.
More from Balbina Huang in a moment, but first, here's Miles Morgan with his take on the week in Canberra.
Well, thanks, Brett. The Prime Minister was thousands of kilometres away from Parliament this week, but he couldn't escape the questions from one of the year's most anticipated political interviews. Whether you liked it or hated it, the former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce sat down for a paid interview alongside his former staffer Vicky Campion, who'd given birth to their son, Sebastian. Mr. Joyce told Seven's Sunday Night program he knew the pregnancy, which was the result of an affair, would end his time as leader of the Nationals Party.
I knew that the day would come where I'd have to step down. I wasn't going to have Seb as the Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. I was going to make that was absolutely certain. Mm. And I suppose towards the end I was fighting more out of spite than logic.
It does raise the question, though, of why he stayed in that position for so long if he knew his career as Deputy PM was over. But Malcolm Turnbull, visiting a drought-affected farm in the New South Wales town of Trangie, said the issue had been given enough attention and wished the couple well. Mr. Joyce's partner alleged senior Conservatives in the National Party told her to terminate her pregnancy.
They said, you're pregnant and you have to get an abortion. And I said, it's too late. It has a heartbeat.
It's something the new Nationals leader and Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack vehemently denied.
Each and every one of those people in the National Party and in the wider coalition are committed to making sure that we build a better Australia, and that's what we do each and every day. So if there are allegations that people are making, then perhaps they should take that up on a personal level with the people they're levelling the allegations against.
As I said, both men were seeing firsthand the effects of drought in Australia, getting as far away from politics as they could. Malcolm Turnbull visited regional New South Wales and outback Queensland to see how the locals were going. And when I asked him, he said climate change was undoubtedly a factor in the big dry.
There's no doubt that our climate is getting warmer. I don't know many people in rural New South Wales that I talk to that don't think that the climate is getting drier and rainfall is becoming more volatile.
Well, speaking of volatility, the threat of foreign interference in Australian politics is more pressing than ever, according to Liberal MP Andrew Hastie. He's part of Parliament's powerful Intelligence Committee, which this week released a report on the government's proposed foreign interference laws. The committee gave the crackdown the green light, but recommended protections for journalists be expanded and the prison sentences for breaching secrecy laws be halved. Mr. Hastie says it's imperative they be made into law quickly.
We need this legislation enacted
before the next five by-elections and certainly before the next general election to protect Australia's political processes.
Back in the capital, the Joyce affair dropped off the political radar quickly as the Treasurer, Scott Morrison, said Australia's economy was performing better than expected. GDP grew by 3.1% over the last year and our exports were growing. So Scott Morrison linked the economic numbers to, you guessed it, the government's proposed personal tax cuts.
This underscores the need to deliver the personal tax plan that we outlined in the budget. That personal tax plan is there to support all working Australians, not just some.
The cost of the proposal was revealed this week, more than a month after the budget. $24 billion per year by the end of the decade. But that's only if the plan becomes a reality. Support for the tax cuts in the Senate continues to dwindle. This week, crossbench Senator Tim Storer said he wouldn't support the government's bill, and the coalition still refuses to split it, so at least some of the plan becomes law. And Brett, that was The Week in Politics.
Finally, we have a time, date and location. US President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will hold their historic handshake at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, June 12 in Singapore. SBS will bring you the momentous moment live on television and online. But what happens next? Balbina Huang served as senior special advisor to US Ambassador Christopher Hill, former Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs at the US State Department under President George W. Bush. I began by asking her who needs this summit more, Donald Trump or Kim Jong-un?
Well, at this point, it's really not clear. I think both leaders, frankly, need it quite badly. And quite interestingly, both for similar reasons, frankly, but both for domestic reasons, but also for international reasons. And I think what I think both leaders are going to manage to do is to turn this into a victory. And I think it's because we have quite interesting leaders. I think President Trump, no matter how this turns out, is going to turn this into a victory. What we have in President Trump is one of the most interesting leaders that the world has ever seen, and certainly in the United States. This is a man who manages to turn everything into a triumph, and whether or not that's reality, this is a man who has managed to turn reality TV into a production. And so he's already turned this summit into a victory. In other words, he's already changed the contours of the entire summit itself. In the beginning, he said it was about denuclearization, and already, now we're 6 or 5 days out, he's already managed to change the entire subject of the summit. And now he's changed the expectations and said that it's no longer really going to be about denuclearization, and said that now this is now the starting process of a very long dialogue, and that perhaps this is now just the start of resetting an entire new relationship. And perhaps it will be, but perhaps it won't be. We don't know. And that perhaps this will just be a first meeting. And so if that is the case, then yes, perhaps then it will be a success. So that maybe just having the meeting alone will be a success. So that in itself will then be a success. So you see, that in itself, having this meeting will in its own way be a historic meeting. So this is a president that will manage to turn a meeting in and of itself into a success.
So how then does Kim Jong-un turn this into a victory?
Well, for Kim Jong-un, this is a man who is the leader of a country who, by all measures, the world has considered to be a failing state. By all measures, this is a country that falls essentially 193rd in the category of nation states. It is a country that has been considered a pariah. It is a country that the world has shunned. that has been put on the sanctions list, that the world has considered the worst actor of all nations, and that the world has essentially coalesced around and considered a threat to the international community. And yet now suddenly the world has essentially put the attention on and is now the leader of the world. The President of the United States is now going to go and meet and is now put on the world stage. And just recently in the last month, the leader of China has hosted. Now we hear that the leader of Russia is going to be hosting him soon. And so he is now on the world stage and is going to be treated as one of the world leaders. And so this is a remarkable victory for Kim Jong-un. And so that in itself is really a remarkable success if the summit is pulled off.
So the big question surely must be, is the hope of denuclearization worth the risk of validating this brutal regime and its leader?
Well, exactly. And this is exactly the dilemma that I think the entire world community faces as we try and attempt to address the problem of North Korea. And I think this is exactly the dilemma that we have been facing, certainly for the last 20 years, as we try to denuclearize North Korea, but most certainly as we try to address the issue, the greater issue of the Korean War. And certainly Australia understands this because Australia was a part of the Korean War. And really, this gets to the greater heart of the issue, which is the fundamental problem of the division of the Korean Peninsula. Because really the nuclear problem that we face with North Korea is really a symptom of the heart of the division of the Korean Peninsula, which really goes back more than 65 years, really to 1945, when this entire issue started, and really does affect the entire stability of Northeast Asia and of East Asia itself, and really is such a profound issue and so difficult to resolve. It cannot really be resolved by one summit meeting between the United States and North Korea. And this is exactly why it has not been so easily solved by any U.S. administration. And so I think on June 12th, I think there are, the expectations of the world is focused on Singapore, but I simply don't think that it will be resolved.
You worked as the senior special advisor to U.S. Ambassador Christopher Hill, who, of course, led the U.S. delegation to the six-party talks back in 2005. When you were working at the U.S. State Department, the approach was very much the carrot and stick approach. We've already seen Donald Trump step away from using the term maximum pressure. In the last 24 hours, his legal advisor, Rudy Giuliani, has spoken about Kim Jong-un getting on his knees and begging for Donald Trump to put this summit back on the agenda to actually make that happen. He said that this is exactly the position you want the North Korean leader to be in ahead of these talks. Given your experience, what do you make of those observations? Is this a leader who should be provoked? Is that where you want Kim Jong-un a few days out from this historic meeting?
Oh, I'm not so sure Kim Jong-un is on his knees begging for Donald Trump to show up in Singapore. From North Korea's perspective, it might actually seem as if it's the reverse, that perhaps it's, the United States on its knees begging, for North Korea to show up. In fact, by all accounts, it's, North Korea is actually not even going to be footing any of the bill, and that actually the United States is scrambling to try to figure out how we're actually going to get North Korea to even show up. So it really may be all a matter of perception. So I'm not so sure about that. And in fact, the price that the United States may be paying is exactly that the United States has backed off by saying we're not calling it maximum pressure anymore. So this is all about, essentially a little bit about saying, okay, let's not call it carrots and sticks for a little while. But it is all about fine-tuning. And look, it is all a little bit about playing games. But I think what's quite interesting is that for once we have an almost evenly matched game. And what I mean by that is for once we have two leaders who it is not just one leader, meaning Kim Jong-un, who is the unpredictable one, the one that we're not so certain is crazy unpredictable. We also, for the first time, have a U.S. president who is also uncertain, seemingly crazy, seemingly unpredictable. We've never seen that in a U.S. president before. I'm not quite so sure that President Trump is so crazy. He's certainly unpredictable, that's for certain. And I think that that is certainly risky. I think it makes the world quite tense. I think it makes the world very uneasy, but perhaps it also makes Kim Jong-un uneasy. And that may be exactly what has brought Kim Jong-un to the table. So it does make the world very, very uneasy.
And it must surely make diplomats like yourself uneasy, because usually you know what's going to happen at these summits because the outcomes are agreed weeks or even months in advance. I understand that North Korea and the United States have diplomats meeting as we speak to try and establish some type of framework. How unusual is that for a summit of this magnitude?
Oh, extremely unusual. And I think it makes the job for diplomats and all the bureaucrats, and extremely, extremely difficult. On the other hand, I think this is exactly why North Korea has always had the upper hand. And I think this is also exactly why we have always had very, very much difficulty having had any kind of solution until now. Because the North Koreans have always been able to beat everybody else at their game. They've always been in control. And I think perhaps for the first time that North Korea may not have the upper hand. So again, while it makes the job extremely difficult for everybody else, and especially all of us watching, that perhaps this may be the first time that we may actually get some progress. We'll just simply have to see.
We did, of course, see progress in 2007. We saw some of those reactors blown apart and shut down. There were encouraging signs. Your former boss, the Ambassador Christopher Hill, spoke positively about the progress that was being making. And then, of course, that all collapsed into a heap. How optimistic are you this time around, given the circumstances, the fact that we're seeing a US president and a North Korean leader meet for the first time and meet in a neutral country like Singapore? How optimistic are you that this is the start of a process of peace on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, I think we have to be very careful. I think we have to step away from expectations about denuclearization, at least for June 12th. And I think President Trump himself has now been very clear about that. I think June 12th may be the start of possible optimism about the process towards resetting a relationship towards the process towards peace in terms of a new relationship, a political relationship towards peace, as you say, towards resolving the conflict in terms of the military war involving the conflict regarding the war itself. And that is different from the denuclearization process. These really are two separate issues. Well, the issues themselves aren't separate, but I think they are two separate essentially realms. And I think this is where President Trump really is separating the two. The denuclearization process, I think, the negotiators are separating out. And I think the political process itself may be the trigger for a whole new set of dialogue and negotiations for the denuclearization process to come afterwards.
So that's your best-case scenario. What's your worst-case scenario, and should we be frightened or anxious about this whole summit collapsing and what the consequences of that might be for the world?
Well, I don't know if frightened is necessarily the word, but I do think we ought to be concerned that North Korea is essentially going to walk away with essentially exactly what it wanted, which is that it will essentially get from the United States a peace, meaning that, that essentially it will walk away and say, oh, the United States no longer has any reason to have a military conflict with us. And now it no longer has any more urgency about the denuclearization process. In other words, we can now drag out the negotiation process, which is a very, very technical process, over a number of months, years, and during this very, very, very long dragged out process, which could take years, that essentially, it can continue on with its clandestine programs and also, by the way, continue to develop numerous other sorts of threats, which really are very serious, including cyber threats, including other types of WMD threats, including biological, chemical. It could include other types of missile development programs, perhaps even other conventional military threats. And these are very threatening to other U.S. allies in the region, particularly Australia, Japan, South Korea, and other regional allies in Southeast Asia, and that these are very serious threats. And so this really is very concerning. And never mind North Korea's other threats, within its own country, including human rights abuses. And this certainly does not further any U.S. interests. And this would certainly be a problem for the United States and the world.
We know that this will be a huge event. These are two leaders who love cameras, they love the attention, they love a crowd, and they love a show. How extraordinary will the security be for this summit? We know that when that letter was hand-delivered to Donald Trump at the White House, the Secret Service were testing it for chemical and biological agents before he was allowed anywhere near it. Is it even possible that these two leaders can be left alone together in the one room without their security details? How will the talks actually take place?
Well, this is what is so remarkable, is that, of course, when it involves this level, meaning presidential, of any leader, certainly, the security is so immense, but especially for the United States and North Korea, one can imagine that the security would just be so incredible. And to carry this off in such a short period of time, and for the leader of North Korea to travel out of the country when this is a man who has not traveled out of the country so rarely in his entire leadership for 5 years, and to travel this far is really quite exceptional. And so that in itself is remarkable. But then you have these two incredible personalities that really are just really beyond almost any other leaders really in the world, and talk about sort of really spectacular personalities. And we've already seen this even with Kim Jong-un, just almost eccentric personalities, but also quite exuberant personalities, and really sort of acting out of script, and we know this, and we also know that they're very charismatic. So we can imagine that during the time that they will have personally, that they will really act not really within their schedules, and we can imagine that they probably will spend time that will not be in script. So I think that they will be acting in ways that we can probably not expect or really, it will be something that none of their schedulers, frankly, will be planning.
I'm not sure I feel entirely comfortable with the words nuclear disarmament and off script in the same sentence, but it certainly promises to be an extraordinary 24, 36 hours when those two leaders are together. Do you think that your president is about to pull off one of the biggest deals of his lifetime?
Oh, possibly. Well, this is a man that, does everything over the top, and I'm certain that he is not going to disappoint in any way.
Can we expect to see a Trump Tower, do you think, in Pyongyang anytime soon?
That would not surprise me in any fashion.
And that is it for another week. I'll talk to you next Friday from that historic summit in Singapore. Have a great weekend.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.
sbs.com.au